Hello and welcome to the Managing Madrid podcast. It is a gorgeous Sunday evening here in New York City. This is Gabe Lezra, and I am joined on the phone by only one of the other three normal hosts. It's my buddy Josh Zeitlin. Josh, what's going on, man?
Hey, man. Good to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you.
Old school, original Managing Madrid podcast.
Throwback. Original throwback player. Edition. Managing Madrid podcast. Luckily, we have invested a little bit more heavily into our software and into our hardware, and so hopefully this is going to sound a little bit better to you than just us talking through a speakerphone and recording it with my computer speakers next to my phone on speakerphone, which is how we originally did the podcast.
There were some classics where, like, there was one where you called me when I was out on the street in New York, and there was a whooshing of traffic as I was walking.
Yeah, I remember that. That happened like 2 months ago, right?
That was quite grim. Yeah. But,
So Josh, it was a big weekend.
Poor Keon is sick, but we should all wish him a happy, good recovery.
Keon, we feel bad. Get better soon, my man. We miss you very much. Mike, what the fuck? I have no sympathy for you. You said at 5:45 that you were down to record at 7.
All right.
And then at 7 when we were on.
Don't air the dirty laundry in public, all right?
No, I want to shame Mike because everyone who's listening should go tweet at Mike because the dude, I don't understand you, Mike. That's all I'm saying. He says, I'm going to be on at 7, and then at 7:02 he's like, oh, shoot, I'm watching the Giants, so I can't come on.
Oh, are you serious? I missed that part.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
That's on you, Mike. It's on you.
Okay, well. All right. We'll see how it is.
Anyways, whatever. Big, wonderful weekend for Madrid. Madrid beats Osasuna 5-2 at the Bernabeu. A much, much better game for Madrid than the previous one. Cristiano Ronaldo makes his season debut back from injury that he suffered in the Euro Cup final. Scores a goal 5 minutes into that match. And Karim Benzema, also back from injury, hits the post twice, which is pretty funny. But overall, both those dudes played a very good game. Other standouts, Luka Modric, just fantastic, and we'll get into this. And then after that, we're going to talk big seismic shifts in La Liga as Barcelona lose to Alaves in a really shocking game that, while most people called it anti-football because I was asked to talk about anti-football by Keon and Josh, and I this is one of the, I like this, Josh, because not only is it a throwback pod hosters, this is a throwback topic where we got to talk about how people are obnoxious who talk about anti-football. Remember that? That was one of our first things that we got into, where they said people would get at Mourinho for playing a kind of defensive game, and we got to defend that. So I'll go ahead and do that now with Alaves also.
I'm excited. Can't wait.
And then we're going to take some questions. We have a number of questions for this week. Luckily, international football has gone for a while, and we're jumping into the business end of the season. And I think we're going to try to do a little bit of a preview, Josh, because Madrid has the Champions League back this week, right?
Yeah, we're playing Sporting on Wednesday, I believe.
Yes, so we'll do a little bit of a preview of that match against Sporting, which is coming up, and we're going to take your questions. So all in all, not a long show, but a lot of content, a lot of stuff to get to. So let's just jump right in, my man. So Josh, big win for Madrid, looking much better than that win against Celta. Now, how much do you chalk up Madrid's 5-2 victory over Osasuna to Madrid playing really well, or do you think that Osasuna actually didn't execute a game plan as well as maybe they should have?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of people, us, you know, who follow Spanish football closely, were really excited to see Osasuna come back. And I think that's something we talked about maybe at the end of the year. when we saw it, when we knew that they were coming back on one of our podcasts, that Osasuna are known as kind of giant killers. And so if you follow English soccer, you know, people talk about a wet Tuesday night in Stoke. Well, the equivalent in the Spanish league is a wet Tuesday right. night in Pamplona. And well, they're kind of
the other one.
Balaidos, whatever, you know, in Celta de Vigo. These kind of, I mean, they're not quite Basque, but they have a kind of, well, it's sort of debatable. They're right on the edge of the Basque country, and they consider themselves to be quasi-Basque. That's a point that we're not going to get into. But,
no, we're not. 100%.
They have a Basque style of football, so it's kind of more aggressive, more tenacious, more physical, and they tend to do very well against the big teams, even away from home, but especially at home. And right. So I was kind of expecting them to play very differently than they did. You know, the first goal especially, but, you know, quite a few, you know, they conceded on set pieces several times. I mean, really sloppy marking on set pieces, very poor goalkeeping. I mean, I don't know what you can do about that, but except have a different goalkeeper. But the high line, I mean, how can you play such a high line, Gabe?
And if you're going to play a high line, right, you got to make sure that you're prepared to cover in the back, because, you know, as we saw, Celta played a very high line against Madrid and pressed and didn't concede tons of, you know, opportunities on the break, because the truth is that Madrid, it's not, five goals was actually pretty unlucky for Madrid if you consider the fact that, like, just removing everything else, Karim Benzema hit the post twice. That could easily have been seven, right? And so,
I mean,
it wasn't just that, right? It was
a little unfair, right? Because I think that two of those goals were very good fortune for Madrid, right? I mean, Danilo's goal is basically the keeper claws at it and completely makes a hash of it. I mean, there's basically something out of nothing, and then he palms it into the path of Danilo, and then Danilo smacks it, and again, the keeper just makes a dog's breakfast out of it, and it goes into the net. I mean, it was a good hit from Danilo. I mean, what is he supposed to do? Like,
I'm going to need you to just hit the brakes and talk to me a little bit about the phrase dog's breakfast. What is that?
It's a mess. It's something that's not attractive. It's kind of a garbage heap.
All right.
It's a British term.
Okay.
I quite like it.
Okay. You
pick it up, use it.
Yeah.
I've been getting a lot of flack at the medical school
right
for
now
using the phrase sticky wicket.
Yeah.
And it's just not cricket. So I don't know. I mean,
Jesus Christ,
Josh. English. Yeah.
All right. So fair enough that Madrid did get lucky, but
the Pepe goal. I mean, what is going on there?
I mean, look, yeah. So it wasn't. Let's just quickly recap. So the first goal was very brilliantly executed by Madrid. A perfect counterattack. The fact is, there are few things in world sports that are quite as beautiful as Madrid full out on a counterattack. This team is still gorgeous and brilliant at this particular aspect of football, even if it's one that has been less emphasized since Mourinho left. Bale, working with Bale, Ronaldo, Danilo, all of these players are so fast and they're so pinpoint in the way they can do it. And Bale has, you know, I'll just quickly say Bale has improved so much in his ability to run with the ball and, you know, while being harried and make the right decision at the end of the run. So what happened was that Danilo,
absolutely lovely run.
Oh, it was gorgeous. Danilo,
it wasn't offside. It looked when you looked at it in real time, you thought that has to be offside
because
he's
of
so
how much
far
space
ahead of
right
the defender. But when, you know, he's completely onside by at least a yard, and he turns his defender. He's on the shoulder blind. He's on his blind side of the fullback.
Right.
And the ball comes over the top, and it's a lovely ball, but, you know, and then he's off to the races, and he just completely...
It was a great ball, I think, from Danilo in particular, to see it and put the ball exactly where it needed to be. And as the ball drops in, you just see Bale, and there's no one around him, and so he's running right at the goal. There's a defender trying to collapse on him. And he looks up, sees that, yes, he could probably take a shot, but he also notices that Cristiano Ronaldo is running perfectly in sync with him, and he has this tiny little beautiful window to slot that ball through and give Cristiano Ronaldo, first of all,
very
his first goal. in the tournament, and also a perfectly easy goal to score, right? There was not much that Cristiano Ronaldo needed to do other than be there to tap that thing in. It was just a brilliant, brilliant way to start this game, especially against a team that had a lot of designs on taking the match to Madrid. I think the first 5 minutes or so of the game showed a very, you know, possessed Osasuna, who was very much looking to take the game at Madrid, and that goal kind of unraveled things for them a little bit. But
I thought that it was a really, really nice goal, and I think that, you know, defensively it showed how disorganized the center backs of that team are. I thought that was a real, really big problem for them. But I mean, all credit to how skillfully Gareth Bale made that run. It was so fast. I mean, it completely collapsed their defensive organization. But that's why I think a team like Osasuna should not play such a high line against a player like Gareth Bale. But I think it's great for Ronaldo to come back. You know, he's coming back from a serious injury, and he gets a chance like that. I mean, that is like the easiest chance he will ever get in his career.
Right, and he's not Gareth pushing Bale hard now to like kind of open his scoring tally for the season. Like,
perfect.
It's perfect, you know, for him. I will also note that one of the differences between this match and the previous one, right, against Celta, was that Zidane did not start any of the South Americans that were away with their team. So Marcelo didn't start, and Nacho filled in very ably for him at left back. And then Casemiro didn't start. Kovacic played there next to Modric in the center of the midfield in a very creative and, I thought, a very dynamic midfield trio, with Kroos sitting a little bit behind, but still, like, you know, kind of surging forward. Just a very overall strong midfield creatively. For Madrid. Yes, he really was.
One of the best games ever in a Madrid shirt. I mean, really, I mean, it attracted quite a lot of attention, actually, in the international media, in a way that La Liga matches against, you know, somewhat more middling opposition. No offense to Osasuna. You know, it's not one of the, you know, the biggest games in the calendar year. It you know, people stood up and took notice of how unbelievable that performance was, and
he just controlled that game, even though the entirety of Osasuna's strategy was partially to harry him in midfield. He just took control of that game in a way that, you know, he does, but normally it's not as obvious, and it's not as much like Modric just kind of doing whatever he wants whenever he wants. It's just he was playing and just absolutely possessed.
Well, he had a lot of freedom, and I think that having two more possession-oriented midfielders behind him probably gave him that freedom. So
I was about to say that I think
a kind of a 4-3-3 type formation, and it's not clear that this exactly was a 4-3-3, but you know, I was just listening to a fantastic podcast that The Guardian put out, which all of you who are tactically minded should listen to, in which I can't remember the name of the journalist, was interviewing Ruud Gullit, the great Dutch former Milan player and then coach. And he was written a book on tactics, and they were discussing tactics, and he talked through all these different formations, and it was very enlightening. And when he talked about 4-3-3, he talked about how the important thing to look at is the triangle facing forward, or is it facing backwards?
Right.
And that's sort of the critical thing to look at as a fan, or as a sort of more casual observer. And so in this case, you have two sort of deeper lying midfielders that free up this more creative player,
so,
which I think is Kroos, the opposite of what we've been. Mm-hmm, what we've
that
been
is for. Right, because normally Casemiro, whose entire and unique
more of a destroyer
duties are to be that destroyer figure. What we did instead is we stacked the defensive box, trying to get Kovacic and Kroos in the middle to, you know, make the passing lines more complicated, and not, because obviously neither of them are particularly physically powerful and overpowering forces, and they then would support this kind of creative center midfielder where Modric was. And I think it was important, Josh, in noting that the in this case the triangle was facing forward. That's a really important tactical innovation. It's an important tactical decision for Zidane, especially considering that that's actually a position that a number of people who haven't traditionally played in the midfield triangle, actually can play, which is, in particular, you saw that Modric came out for Marco Asensio, who is traditionally been played in the attacking trio. And I thought Asensio looked pretty damn good in that midfield. I mean, like, the man it looks pretty damn good generally, but I thought he looked pretty good. And that's an important thing to note, that if, you know, if Madrid wants, they can flip that around and create almost this 10. Not obviously it's not a 10 exactly, but to create this kind of more attacking center midfielder.
I thought Asensio
looked very good there.
I think it's a more,
it's not a 10 though.
More of a trequartista almost, like a deeper lying midfielder who orchestrates from a little bit deeper in the midfield. But it is a very interesting role. A little bit more free flowing. You know, I think it was a very interesting game for him, and I think that we're seeing, a play from Modric that we haven't seen since his heyday under Ancelotti before he got injured, and that was the best Madrid has played, perhaps in my lifetime of watching, which is not granted that as long as yours or. Granted that long in the grand scheme of things, but you know, that was some of the best football I've ever seen played,
right.
And the most exciting football I've ever had the pleasure to see Madrid play. And then Modric had that knee injury.
Yes. That's right.
And so he is back to that level of form, and Zidane has managed to construct, or is managing to construct, a situation that can accommodate that.
Yes,
that is very. That's very exciting.
It's very exciting, and it's crucially important to understanding the development evolution of this squad. I think, Josh, another thing that we should mention, right, is how impressive Kovacic has looked this season, and it really speaks to Zidane's. I think both Zidane's ability to kind of reset over the summer, and Kovacic's ability to press and convince the manager with hard work that he should be included, right? Kovacic looked great, and he really does provide, him at his best, really does provide cover to the Modric-Kroos type of dynamic center midfielder, right? Because that actually is what Kovacic, you know, has played and was brought in to play as, right? Which is this same type of almost a, you know, a Modric or a Kroos role, maybe with a little bit more deep-lying focus, as he was playing a kind of box-to-box role. I thought he was really good in this match, and I've thought he's been really good basically the entire preseason, and it is, I gotta tell you, this is one of the moments where I'm gonna go ahead and recognize that this is on me, but I thought he should have been loaned out. I was totally off base, and I want to say that Boz, our own friend, mentioned that it's silly to try to loan him out, and I was really just looking at the age, right? He was 21, 22. It's fine to loan someone who's 21, 22 out, but the truth is this dude is definitely good enough to have an important role on this squad, so I'm really glad that he wasn't loaned out.
Loans are tricky. I think that it can work out really well, but I think that in the past we've seen that it generally...
Yeah,
it often winds up that the player never comes back to play for the club, and it can wind up that player winds up having a great career somewhere else. But it's not. I would say the one example I can think of is Thibaut Courtois, but of somebody who really genuinely became world class.
Dani Carvajal, I think,
but
he
was a buyback clause. He was a buyback clause. He wasn't alone.
Yeah,
I mean, I know that's sort of similar.
That's kind of an academic difference.
I can't actually think of a loan.
Marco Asensio
player. Yeah, I mean, but I'm talking about an older loan player.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
In where sort of like a fully not like a youth player, but like an older loan player who went out and then came back and then. You know, oh, you need to go out and get a little more experience. And
no,
then they came back
fair.
And were world class. It doesn't happen very often.
That's definitely fair.
Courtois is the one that springs to mind, and he's a goalkeeper where age is not quite as important anyway.
Yeah. So another thing that I wanted to mention about this match, Josh, is that one of the things that we saw in the Celta match, and maybe this is just because Celta's slightly better coached, but Madrid managed to move the ball and use the wide areas in a way that they just didn't seem to be willing or interested in doing against Celta. And I don't know who exactly is to blame for that. I think it's probably because Celta set up in a 5-3-2, which basically ceded the wings to Madrid, at least at the like they played a press that also ceded the wings, which is kind of silly because the best way for Madrid as a team to get out of a press is to move the ball to one of their speedy wingers and just have that person kind of run up the pitch a little bit and link up with the attacking Trident, which is exactly 100% what happened on the first goal of the match. So it was kind of a incomprehensible tactical decision. Like, if you're going to play a 5-3-2, the move might be at that point then to try to you know, kind of cede possession and play yourself on the counterattack rather than, you know, playing a really high line and trying to get the ball back and play that way. It was an odd combination of structure and tactics, I thought, from Osasuna.
Really get why Osasuna chose to play five at the back. I mean, I think that playing a three-man central defense, I mean, the idea, I think, has to be that you get to have a spare man in so that you can essentially always right. overload whenever they're putting forwards against your back line, you always have a spare man. But then when you push the whole line forwards, you lose the whole purpose of that. So what I don't understand is what the purpose of that was, right? So mm-hmm. if you're going to play the offside trap, I think you kind of lose some of the benefits. I kind of feel like playing a five-man defense is good when you're playing deep, because the whole benefit to me is if you play really compact, yeah. then you get this right. massive numbers in defense, you get to overload in defense, and then you get your wingbacks can overload in the midfield. And
yeah, I mean, Josh, it's possible that Josh just cut out, but I'm just going to keep talking because I actually have a number of things that I want to add. Josh, are you there? I think it's possible that Josh cut out. We may have to edit this. It's okay. Oh, there he is. All right. So, Josh, you want to? I think you were basically finished with your point, but if you want to finish up.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that you lose all the benefits of that formational change. So when you push forward as high and as suicidally high as they did, it just doesn't make sense to me why you would do that.
Right. I agree. So I also wanted to, like, now that we've talked about some of the interesting parts of this match in the positives, let's also mention that, you know, other positives from this match, I think we should at least mention that Nacho looked very strong at times for much of the game. I think before everyone's, you know, Madrid went up 4-0, 5-0. I mean, like, it was quite a game for Madrid, but then the defense started to slip. Before that, Nacho had looked very strong in the left back. So that actually could be a emergency fill-in.
Well, the defense slipped right when Modric was taken off, substituted. I mean, that's... one minute after that was their goal.
Yeah, he was substituted. Yeah,
my opinion was that the timing was that. Sorry, was that the result of a loss of midfield control? Was the ideology of the?
Yeah, I mean
Oriol Riera goal, sort of sloppiness, disorganization. Like, Modric was the sort of the commander. He was
for me.
He was keeping. In the
I have a tough time saying that. I think that maybe later in the, but it's 1 minute. Like, there's not that much time to like lose total control. I mean, that what I saw there was just Madrid's up by five. You know, they're trying to beginning to take their thought, you know, head out of the game mentally. There's a substitution, and then suddenly, you know, there, you know, that leads to a couple of quick errors, and then there's a goal. I'm not sure that. The substitution is the proximate cause of
Well, I mean, I think it clearly is the proximate cause in the sense that whenever you have a substitution, there's a moment of confusion and disorganization,
yeah.
right? But
yeah.
I think it's certainly arguable whether you know, his presence on the pitch itself is relevant.
Right.
But especially because he's quite short and it was a headed goal corner. Or not from corner,
I gotta
from
tell
across,
you, I don't wanna say it like I do wanna say it. I wanted to mention this. I thought it was bad goalkeeping, actually.
Oh yes. Kiko Casilla not very impressive, and I think he will not be pleased with his performance today. But the fact that the other goalkeeper, Pérez, was so abysmal, will at least spare him some blushes.
I mean, and he also saved a penalty, right? So we can talk about that in a second. But I thought that Kiko, like, there was a lot of people talking about how Kiko Casilla has been. Yeah, look, people were giving him more props for the penalty. For me, actually, this goal was quite bad. I think that any other world-class goalkeeper would have seen that ball was dipping, and Kiko didn't jump for it. He kind of looked at it, and I think there was a moment where he had to decide whether I'm going to try to jump or whether you call this over, and he couldn't make the decision quick enough, and then the ball kind of popped in behind him. It was not a good showing from him, and I think that a couple of strides back and a little tip, and that ball doesn't go in. It wasn't, you know, maybe it was a tougher save than I'm making it out to be. But man,
I think the consensus in the press was that he was at fault. I mean, I don't think you're the only person who thinks that, and certainly that was my reading as well, was that he didn't do a good job.
So Madrid was up 5.
He also
5.
Just looked kind of uncomfortable during the game.
I agree, and I felt that way for most of his time at Madrid, actually. I don't – look, he's a backup keeper,
He's a perfectly serviceable backup keeper.
In fact, he's one of the better backup keepers Madrid has had since Diego López.
Diego López is
a world-class keeper, and Kiko Casillas is not, right? And so that's the thing, right? So anyways –
But we are all looking forward to Keylor Navas's return.
Right, we are. And Keylor Navas would not let those goal. Would not have let that one in for sure. That being said, Kiko Casilla did come up big when. So let's just get into this for a second. I have more to say about the other parts of this game that we haven't talked about. For example, how impressive Kroos was on the two set piece goals, because at least the one involving Ramos was clearly a tactically designed play. It wasn't a just knock this one in and everyone tried to jump for it. There was a disguised run. Cristiano.
Yeah, Morata blocks it's almost like a pick. Like Morata blocks off the defender from getting to him and
Cristiano makes a very aggressive, loud run to the back post, drawing a number of defenders. Sergio Ramos cuts in front, unmarked, and Kroos puts that ball right on his head. I mean, there's no...
I mean, it was perfectly placed. I still think, though, that it's kind of shocking that nobody picks up Ramos. Like, if you watch the tape, he's not picked up at any point in his run.
Right.
Like, no point is he picked up. It's kind of almost strange, but... this is definitely an oversight. I mean, it's a beautiful run. I mean, it's a perfect run. He comes diagonally in your post and you know, from that position, he's going to put a really good header on. But I think it's a dereliction of defending duty.
Yeah, I agree.
For Osasuna. I'm a little shocked, actually, that a team of that.
And all I was trying to say is not to, you know, to take anything away from the how badly Osasuna played, but also just to say, to add the fact that it's just true that Kroos is one of the best, you know, free kick takers and just generally set piece takers, not in terms of the ability to score the ball, though I'm sure he'd be able to do
indirect,
that.
Indirect but free kick takers and corner takers.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
I think he's the best one I've seen at Madrid since maybe Beckham. In that ability to put that ball wherever they were. I remember back in the early aughts when Madrid had this designed set play between Beckham and Roberto Carlos, where everyone would rush in and try to crowd the keeper, and Roberto Carlos would sneak up to the top of the box, and Beckham would drill a ball without any curvature or anything, just knuckled right onto Roberto Carlos's left foot, and he just smack it as hard as he could out of the
that
air.
Was a lovely one.
And it was a class, and it was a set play that Madrid would run ran a few times, like, you know, almost once a game, simply because they had two players that were just that good. Beckham could do it every single time, and Roberto Carlos had the strongest left foot I've ever seen. So it was a very interesting little set piece. And I bet something similar could be done with Kroos and, you know, whomever, right? You know, any of the wonderful player, Modric, for example.
Yeah, I mean, Kroos is a really wonderful player, and I think people devalue that kind of contribution, you know, indirect free kicks and set pieces. I mean, I remember we used to rely on Xabi Alonso for that, and when Xabi Alonso left, that was something I was concerned about, is who was going to replace Xabi Alonso's contribution in indirect free kicks and corner kicks. And Kroos has done admirably in that, and I think he's doing a really great job. But I mean, his delivery for Pepe's goal was also very nice.
Also fantastic,
And admittedly, I mean, Pepe's header was not as impressive as Ramos's, like, drilled, beautiful, gorgeous header. But it was right at the keeper. I don't know what he was doing. Come on. And then he just kind of palms it up into the net. I mean, to be fair, I mean, they say, you've played at a higher level than me, but my understanding is that anybody would tell you, you're headed down into the ground is the hardest to save. And it does go down into the ground and take a kind of weird bounce, and then he kind of mishandles it. But he's a professional goalkeeper.
There should have been a block there, you know. But yeah, I think that the goal of the match, maybe other than the first one, was the fifth one, Luka Modric. Oh, man. He controls. So the way this ends up going is there's a cross into the middle. Morata receives I think it was probably an offside position. It wasn't obvious at all. So no harm, no foul. And then whips around and, finds himself with people in front of him, drops that ball back. Modric has one touch, weaves it around the defender, and just pits this beautiful curving ball into the side netting from outside the area. Just unbelievably good shot.
It's a lovely strike.
A capstone on man of the match performance from Lukita. It was just awesome.
I mean, he's really making himself known for that kind of strike now.
So just going back to one of the first topics, Josh, what did you make of Madrid's tactics here with the double pivot in the triangle with the triangle facing forward type of tactics? Do you think this is something that Madrid could roll out again in the future, or is this just a vestige of the fact that Casemiro was probably tired and just flown in from international duty, where, as we mentioned last podcast, he had an incredibly good match?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it is a viable strategy, and one that I've been interested for us to try before. I think that if you go back to Ancelotti's first season, we did play with a kind of a similar role.
Xabi Alonso
if you remember before Khedira, or when Khedira, before he got his injury, we played a little bit like that. I do think it's a viable strategy. The question for me is, against a better team that's more competitive in midfield, whether that is going to get swamped.
It might
right?
be too soft.
So if you have it, well, it's not even too soft exactly, but is it going to get overloaded in midfield, right? If you have a team that essentially plays four midfielders in the center, or a team, because they overload.
4-5-1 or something, trying to overload the center.
Yeah, if you have 4-5-1, or if you have a against Atleti, for example, where they're, one of the forwards drops into center midfield, right, and then the fullbacks come up and then talk close. It's just not clear to me that those two midfielders can compete like that when they're not.
I'd be interested to see it. And the problem that I have.
Barcelona does play, essentially like that. I mean, they play with one back, but
that person is Busquets, though, and who's like.
Right, who's one of the best distributors of the ball in world football.
But that's the thing, right? So I feel like right now Madrid is stuck with two formations, both of which have their pluses, right? This one and then the Casemiro one, where I think that the Casemiro formation for Madrid presents a situation where if I were an opposing player or opposing coach, I would just circle Casemiro on the on the pitch and say, this is the person, like, just harry him. He's going to make mistakes. He's not good at distributing. we will.
Yeah, I think the problem with the doing midfield. That is that they'll just, you know, Madrid has pretty good verticality, so we can just bypass Casemiro.
Well, that's like, the attempt, but the Celta game showed that wasn't, you know, something that would work. Or, like, it didn't work then. Maybe, and as I mentioned, it was because it was super hot, and there was normally in a game Madrid would run a little bit more, and there'd be higher level of fitness. But
we also have to have, you know, Ronaldo and Bale and, right. and Benzema for that to work. Because, you know, I mean, I guess Morata is good at knocking balls down out of the air, so he is useful for that strategy. But in order to play balls long.
So let's quickly talk about Morata before we go on. So Morata did not have his best match, though he was very involved. No. He just seemed off. He just couldn't get his shots on target. He, would try to do moves. They just wouldn't work. And he wasn't replaced, but Benzema came on, and it showed, you know, I actually really have liked Morata, and I do think he brings something to the team that's very different, to the extent even also that there are going to be games where it might actually be preferable to have someone like him in the match, simply because of the sort of things that he brings, which is a additional, you know, height, physicality, and a back-to-the-goal presence where he can control the ball and hold it up for people, right? That is something. He definitely hasn't been a slouch at distributing. That being said, as soon as Benzema came on, man, did you see a difference in, you know, he just showed off his ability to play anywhere on the pitch, create, and he was almost like watching a center attacking midfielder. And I forgot how much watching Karim Benzema play was like watching someone who is basically playing as a false nine, but who is also a nine, right? Kind of coming in and just this unbelievable creative spark that it wasn't even necessarily just for him, but for other people, where he would just, you know, find these perfect pinpoint passes, create space just in the way he moved, both on and off the ball. As we all know, I'm a huge Benzema fan, but
he's a useful player for Madrid, because I don't think many conventional strikers can succeed in Madrid's system when you have two wide forwards of the type that we do. I just don't think that you could play somebody like, you know, Morata. It's very hard for him to do well when you have Ronaldo and Bale cutting into his space. So you have to have somebody who's willing to come back and to pull the strings a little bit. And that's what Benzema does best.
Yes.
That Benzema would do better is that when he needs to step up and take the chance, which we all know he can do better than almost anybody, he needs to do it. And sometimes Benzema doesn't. I don't know if it's a question of belief. He's a very psychological player, you know, in the sense that he's a player, we know from his past that he's a player that needs constant reassurance. He needs to feel a certain way. He's very streaky, you know. So it's not clear to me whether, like, why he can do so well in certain competitions like the Champions League and he has a harder time scoring in the league. It's not clear to me why he doesn't shoot in some circumstances, but I would prefer that he sometimes were a little more selfish than he is, because I think that he could easily, you know, be a kind of a little bit more like a Robert Lewandowski figure, but I don't think that he plays that way.
I agree. That actually is a huge negative for Benz. And the truth is that, you know, he does have these stretches where he just doesn't convert. I don't know. It's annoying, but Madrid has enough firepower where it doesn't normally come back to bite Madrid. So, Josh, I think the negatives of this match, and we're just going to finish this, and then we're going to quickly go into the other games around La Liga, talk about how, you know, things are shaping up, and then we're going to jump into a quick preview of Sporting, and then questions. So, the negatives I think tonight or in the match, Josh, were that Madrid's defense just kind of, other than I think Kiko Casilla, who I think was probably my worst player of the match, I think that Madrid just kind of lost focus, and I think it was particularly evident on the non-goal penalty missed play where Madrid essentially let Osasuna receive in space, slot the ball through whoever was, I think it was Nacho, was just not tracking back well. That player rushed one-on-one at Casilla. Sergio Ramos had to do this absolute absurd challenge from behind that, man, did I think that was going to be a red card. Not just a goal score, but like a red card, because the man was running at Casilla. So Sergio Ramos takes him out. Not a lot of contact on review. The ball bounces from that challenge to another Osasuna player. There's no one near him, and he just slots that ball into the corner. That would have made the game 5-2 at that point. So not a catastrophe, but everything about that was bad until the referee did not allow for the advantage, annulled the goal.
Just completely shocking. I mean, it's just sort of hard to
spot. Incomprehensible.
Understand. And then they don't score the penalty. So it's like,
yeah,
sort of hard to understand where the referee's coming from. I understand if the referee has already blown his whistle, there's really nothing that he can do. But he has to, you know, he's got to play advantage. He can always blow his whistle later. It's such a misapplication of the advantage rule.
And it also showed
he's taken a goal away from Osasuna. I don't.
Just incomprehensible.
It's shocking.
I think in some really circumstances, sad. The Osasuna may have wanted, if he was going to give a red card to Ramos and give the penalty, maybe they would take it. But man,
but
I feel like
you get
the
red card
goal
after. You still get the red card after. That's the thing, is the red card can be given after the advantage is played if he decides that the advantage is no longer happening. That's the whole point of the advantage rules.
Right.
Like, you play the advantage if after like a few seconds it looks like the advantage is no longer there, then you blow.
Right. So, I mean, I think that, but the truth is that it wasn't, I don't think it showed some big, huge flaw in Madrid.
It's a lack of mental focus to some degree, which I think is disappointing. You know, I think that it's understandable when you're 5-0 up that you lose a little bit of focus. But I would like to see just control the game. You know, it's practice for other games. And also, you know, Osasuna are no chumps. Like, you know, respect your opposition. They scored 2 goals. It could have been more. They could have scored 1 in the first half. I mean, they hit the bar, I think. So it could have been a nervy end to the game. And then, you know, what would have happened if we had squandered a 5-0 lead? I mean, that would have been really quite embarrassing.
Yeah,
so
yeah, agreed.
It's just the sort of thing, like, why put yourself in that situation? Just control the game, see it out.
And the defense, you know, I feel like there's
Put it away beyond any reasonable.
And the defense should have some modicum of pride in trying to keep that clean sheet. And even after the first goal goes in, you don't want anyone to score
it's sort of a matter of culture. You know, we want to establish a culture at the club, you know, in the team of, you know, conceding goals is not acceptable.
Yes.
You know, I understand we want to score goals, but like, we also would like to have a culture that conceding is not good, even in a game where it doesn't really matter, because then you kind of establish that as a value, and that I think is good in other games. I think if you practice how you play, and I just think it would permeate all of our other games.
So
I don't know. It's not that big of a deal. In the grand scheme of things, I'm pretty happy with this game. I think it's pretty great. I also would like to point out that this game takes us within one game of a record setting a club record. So this was the 15th consecutive La Liga win under Zidane.
It's tied the club record.
Yes, it's tied the club record set by Miguel Munoz in 1960 and 61.
And the next game that we win,
Alfredo Di Stefano's side with Ferenc Puskas and Paco Gento.
If
and
Madrid
one more
win next weekend, they will tie Pep Guardiola's Barcelona for their 16 consecutive wins over 2010-2011, which is quite an impressive thing to think about when you realize that that was probably the best Barcelona of all time.
It's an interesting it's an interesting achievement. Of course, it's being split over the end of last season and beginning of this season. It's maybe not as as kind of useful of a statistic, but it's not 100% clear to me when these other sides set their statistics. But you know, I think we haven't been performing well in La Liga, and it would be nice to have some kind of validation of that. I would prefer that that validation came in the form of a Liga title, but this certainly would be very pleasing, and it would, I think,
well,
Barcelona,
Josh,
would freak out if we did that.
Well, Josh,
so not gonna
speaking
win.
Of La Liga titles, one of the biggest shocks of the season, they probably the biggest shock of the season so far, and one of the biggest shocks of, you know, quite a while, over the weekend, Alaves 2, Barcelona 1 in the Camp Nou. I think that the fact that it was in the Camp Nou is even more shocking to me. Luis Enrique rotated pretty heavily, but that's not an excuse. Alaves is newly promoted. Obviously, they're playing really well, and I think that just pointing out, Kian has asked us to mention that Alaves, please talk about Alaves's anti-football. So he asked us to say that. I don't feel like, I mean, we don't need to get into it, but I think one thing that I would like to mention, though, is that Real Madrid canterano Marcos Llorente is playing right now for Alaves, and he looks fantastic, and he looked fantastic in that match. I think I've got the right Llorente, because actually Madrid has two Llorentes, both of them on loan. But yes, it's Marcos Llorente at Alaves. He is, I mean, look, he's really exciting, and he's playing in this very exciting kind of deep-lying DM role. And they both are, Marcos and Diego, who plays for Malaga, who's also having a great start to the season. So there is an exciting level of talent in the future at that position, to the extent that I'm feeling a little bit more okay that Madrid didn't go grab anyone for that Casemiro type role. I don't know if you're feeling the same way, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't tend to pay too much attention to these canteranos, just because, I mean, I realize that a lot of people at Managing Madrid do love to do that, and that's great. But to me, I know that most of them won't make it to the first team, and I think it's wonderful that we are cultivating a new crop of footballers, and I think many people don't realize that La Fabrica produces some of the, you know, many, right, many players for clubs all over Spain. But the reality is that most of these players that are being hyped now are never going to make it to the first team. So I don't tend to get too excited.
It does seem like Zidane is genuinely making an effort to bring these players up, you know? Like, he obviously knows them very well, right? And so, like, it'll depend on how long
I'll reserve my judgment until until it looks like they might come back to the club.
I mean, truth be told, I don't have that much to say about this match. Like, obviously, for Alaves to beat Barcelona, a number of things had to happen.
Incredible accomplishment. I mean, let's remember that Alaves also drew with Atleti, so that, I mean, they're not chumps. Like, this is a promoted side,
and a promoted side.
I think
side
people
looking
are being
like
very
playing
ungenerous to Alaves here. By the way,
really, what are people saying?
I mean, people like Keon saying, "Oh, talk about Alaves is anti-football." I mean, what are Alaves supposed to do? Go to the Camp Nou and roll over and take it at 7-0? I mean, they're under no obligation to do that. They're a newly promoted side. Barcelona is the one who had to beat them.
Right.
They decided to rotate all their players because they thought they were arrogant, and they thought that Alaves were, you know, easily beatable, despite the fact that Alaves drew with one of the most difficult teams in Spain, you know, Atleti.
Right.
And then, you know, they got what they deserved. I mean, and Alaves played well. Like, they're under no obligation to come out and play a high line and like attack them. I mean, what? It's just ridiculous. Like, Alaves has an obligation to their fans to win the damn game, and they can do that in whatever way that they want.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And
because they won, that means that they did that correctly.
Right, and they just didn't just score a point. They took three from Barcelona in the Camp Nou, which leads Madrid is now leading Atleti by five and Barcelona by three. That's huge already. And obviously that can turn around at any second. And this is
Remember, I mean, by the way, that I want to say in 2010, 2011, in one of the seasons where Pep Guardiola's all-conquering team, you know, stormed the Liga title, they lost 2-0 to Hercules, and then one of the other seasons they lost 2-1 to Numancia. So they have a history of actually almost identical losses to basically promoted teams right after the FIFA break. So at home also.
I mean, so do Madrid, though. The FIFA break is notorious.
Yeah. I'm just saying I wouldn't say that it's like a...
anyone that's celebrating La Liga now is being crazy, and I would say that to their face. But so let's jump forward.
It's a good position. I mean, let's look at where
what we're looking for is over the course of a year, dropping points adds up. So obviously, dropping points now is not ideal. You don't want to drop points yet. You never want to drop points, and anytime you do drop points, it's bad. But it's better to for Madrid to get the points, and like at this point in the season. That is all the analysis I really feel comfortable saying that.
Well, and also it's who do you drop points against, right? Like Real Madrid, when you're thinking about, and Barcelona, when they're thinking about their season, it's like, who can you reasonably count on points against? You certainly can't count on points against the other one, and you can't count on points against Atleti, and you can't count against points, away from home against Sevilla and away from home against Villarreal and Bilbao and places like that. You know, those are really tough places to go. But
you really
you would
should
like
be
to
able
think
to
that
count
you can beat
points.
Newly promoted teams at home. And so if you lose those games, suddenly you think about performance against expected outcomes, right? Real Madrid are currently outperforming Barcelona on expected outcomes, but whatever that means after three games, which is not very much because
so
they still have to play each other.
Let's jump quickly. We have we're going to do 5 minutes on Sporting. I don't have much to say about this other than Madrid is playing Sporting. Obviously, Cristiano started his career there. They are currently leading the Portuguese league, taking a perfect 4 out of 4 from their first four games. That being said, they're not, world beaters. They're good, but they're not world beaters. They are an exciting side with some exciting players and some young talent, but they are also a team that Madrid really should be expected to beat both away and at home. And if Madrid is struggling to get all 3 points against Sporting, I think that is going to be the first moment this season where we've had to have a real reflection about what Madrid can improve. What do you think, Josh?
I think it's a good opponent for Madrid, sort of structurally, because they are they're a relatively attacking side, but they're not a gegen pressing side like Dortmund or something like that. So in that sense, I would think that, who are Madrid likely to struggle against? Some really, really defensive, very solid side that where we have to try to open them up and maybe they hit us on the break, or, a top tier attacking side. I think that a mid tier attacking side is actually, probably one of the more advantageous opponents in theory. But and I think it's also advantageous that Sporting sold their most interesting attacking player, Islam Slimani, the Algeria winger, to Leicester City. It's not actually clear to me if they sold Adrian Silva as well, but I think they might have held on to him. But
I think they did hold on to Silva, but this match is in Madrid, so it's probably a pretty good way to begin the Champions League defense at your own stadium. So Madrid, will feel very much at home. They'll be able to get the love from the crowd. and take a measure of this Sporting team that is basically an unknown because they really haven't played against them in, you know, I think since Cristiano Ronaldo came to the club. So it's a good start. I think it's a fine place to start because a team will force them to take them seriously. And now that Ronaldo and Benzema seem to be back, it's getting closer to the place where Madrid will have their full complement of players, which is good. Very exciting. I don't have much else to say. We may do a midweek pod, possibly, to talk about that. Josh, let's take some questions. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Down?
All right. So
I don't have much to say on Sporting. Unfortunately, I don't follow the Portuguese league too closely.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't really either. So we have a question from one of our patrons, Patreons. Hey, Josh, is it patron or patron? We had this discussion last week.
I think it's patron.
So one of our patrons, Zachary at Zach L. Morin, Morin, asks
thank
us.
Thank you for your patronage, Zach. You should all patronize us if you can.
If you care to, if you want to make a donation to help us invest in better mics, better software, and eventually, you know, better computers on which to do this, because my computer is close to breaking, that will be what these goes to. And like I said, we do donate all of the money that we get from Patreon. It's Patreon account, but patrons. So patrons back into the show, because we love doing this and we would do it. But we do think that we can keep improving in terms of the quality of the sound and the just overall quality. Eventually, we're going to be able to hire a producer who will be able to do things like take emails. And if you wanted to email a longer question or a story or all that stuff, that might be the next step after we all get good mics. So anyways, Zachary asks us, any concern over the Champions League and not going on? No, I'm not concerned about not going on. I think that, you know, I'm not picking Madrid to win the Champions League this year.
I think that's
the history is not good.
The history is not good. Obviously there's a first time for everything and, you know, but the modern history of the Champions League, World Cup, it's very hard to win.
Didn't do it.
The extended season you get after you win the Champions League makes it really, really, really hard to repeat.
Right.
And there are just a lot of other strong teams. So it's just, there's a lot of luck in it.
Not just is there a long season, this is also a season just like 2015 or 2014, 2015 was. This is a season where Madrid is coming off a European summer. So there were international competitions this summer, as I'm sure you all remember. And that, combined with the extended schedule, really could have the potential to burn out some of these players. I don't see us winning it. That being said, Madrid is in a group that Madrid really should not just, you know, come out of, but come out of at the top of the group. And it would be a shock and really not acceptable if Madrid, acceptable but not ideal if Madrid doesn't come first in the group, much less come out of the group.
Yeah, I think that you would think that Madrid is the strongest team in the group and should top the group. But Dortmund is a very strong team and could certainly top the group if Madrid isn't careful. I also think that just looking at the teams around Europe, you would say that Madrid probably, if they're going to play to their level, should aim for semifinals, but or better, semifinals would be a reasonable, good, solid, excellent result, and that we would be very, very happy with. But anything can happen. I mean, you could draw the best team in the competition in the round of 16 and go out. Like, that could happen to you. So
that's definitely true, Josh.
But if you top your group, that makes it less likely.
Much less likely. That being said, as I was on the Colchonero chat last week, or a couple of days ago, with talking with the Atleti, our wonderful guys Jeremy and Martin from Into the Calderon, our SB Nation Atleti blog, and Fernando from VRL USA. Very interesting conversation. I encourage you all to check that out. Atleti is in a very complicated group with both PSV, who took Atleti to penalties, if you all remember last year, and with Bayern Munich. And it's very possible that someone, in many. Well, we know that Bayern Munich. No, they can't get Atleti, but let's say Madrid comes first and Bayern Munich comes second. That's not impossible to think that Madrid might draw Ancelotti's Bayern.
No, it's certainly possible.
So that's why, you know, it's Champions League is tough this year, you know, and then you can compare that group with Bayern, who, you know, won the competition recently, and Atleti, you know, all these incredible teams, PSV. And I even think that PSV deserves to get respect after taking Atleti to penalties over two legs last year. And you look at
that was
Leicester's
one of the best
group.
Penalty shootouts. I mean, woo, all yeah. those penalties were in. I mean, what was it, like 16 penalties yeah. in a row?
It was
scored.
Incredible.
Compare that to the garbage penalty shootout in the World Cup, Italy versus Germany. Was it?
Yeah.
That was the worst penalty shootout in history. It's
it was the
be,
worst oh, I've ever God. Seen. Was it
Simone Zaza, his like
yeah.
preposterous prancing penalty?
He pranced up and then rolled the ball right to the keeper. Incomprehensible.
So bad for him. Anyway,
and what I'm saying, yes. compare that to Leicester. Well, Leicester's unbelievable nightmare of a like, you know, for us. So, anyways, let's go on. But yeah, there's concern.
I mean,
I'm hopeful that Madrid will at least get back to the semifinals this season. But like I said, I think a lot. Madrid...
Realistically, I think semifinals would be a great result. I think that people who think that we should win the Champions League every year. I mean, it's just. That's just not. I mean, Bayern Munich doesn't win the Champions League every year. Barcelona doesn't win the Champions League every year. It's just not. It's not a reasonable expectation to have. Even the final is not a reasonable expectation to have. I think the semifinals every year is not just like is a great result. I think that would really, really good. You're always in it. You have a chance to be in the final every year, and if you're in the final, you can win it. Like that's awesome. And then. If you're in the top four in Europe, that's like an enormous amount of respect that you get around Europe. And I think that's where Madrid needs to be.
So we have a number of questions. Interesting. We already talked about this. We have a number of questions about the Llorentes. And I mentioned Marcos and David. So we have two. Let's I'll just group them together.
Kern, you'll have to handle this. I don't think about
How they looked, but Kern Elliott at Kern Elliott asks us, Marcos Llorente, how has he looked this season at Alavés thus far? And we also have one from Alexandre A. Ndiaye. A. Alex Ndiaye asks us, can Marcos Llorente or Diego Llorente compete with Casemiro for the CDM role next season? I think he asked us from two of his accounts. Just jumping into this, I think if I were Zidane, I would expect both of them to come back and compete with Casemiro for the beginning, for that role next season. Both of them have looked very good. So to answer your question, to answer the first question from Kern Elliott, Marcos Llorente, he's been has his name chanted around the Alavés Stadium already, and he's been fantastic for Alavés. So that's a really exciting. He's 21. He's a very exciting young player. Will he, you know, have a future with Real Madrid? It's not clear, right? But
yeah, I mean, you have to remember that the demands of playing for Alavés and the demands of playing for Real Madrid are not exactly the same. I mean, the level of technical ability required are not necessarily identical. So, and also it's still early days. I mean, he's certainly been playing very well for Alavés, and Alavés has been doing really, really well, and I'm very pleased about that. But still have to wait and see. It's only few games into the season, three games. So
don't want to
prematurely suggest that.
No, and you're right to throw a little bit of cold water on that.
One swallow does not make a summer is all.
Right, exactly.
We have to wait and see over this. And the reality is we don't have to make a decision yet. He's got a whole season to play.
Right. So, and I would also note that he did play against Barca. He looked good. And then Diego has been a standout at Malaga. So I would, to answer the first question, I don't know if they're going to have a future. He's looked good at Alavés. The second question, the competing one, I really do think that they will compete with Casemiro for the starting job next year. If you're asking me to say, will they win that job? that is not something I can say. My gut would be that neither of these two players will be winning that job anytime soon. But I think, Josh, one thing that's very possible from these two players is that because there are two of them, both of them playing in kind of similar roles and playing with similar styles, that one of the, like, a lot of people have been, you know, and I've read comparisons between Diego Llorente at Malaga, not Marcos, but Diego, with Busquets in the way that he has kind of worked for Malaga. And he's even provided a threat going forward, having scored in their first couple games. He's a very exciting talent. Now, obviously, there's no guarantee or whatever, but I think one of them will be, you know, if gun to my head, especially considering the transfer ban, I think will be on the senior team roster next year.
I think the transfer ban makes it very likely that loan players will be returning to the club.
Yes.
And much more so than if the transfer ban wasn't there, because there's no other source of players to add to the roster.
Exactly.
So,
and Madrid does have a pretty wide stable of loan players too.
The fact that Casemiro is not
perfect.
No, that's not what I was going to say at all. The fact that Casemiro is not has no natural backup on the team means that there will probably be a need for somebody to serve as his understudy, at least.
Yes.
Right. I mean, you see that Zidane, as we were talking about earlier, is coming up with other ways to organize the team.
And like,
in Casemiro's absence,
I would rather have David Alaba,
to have somebody who like for like.
So let's take another couple questions, then we're going to wrap this up, because we've actually been, Josh, I don't know if you know this, we've been talking for an hour.
and
you thought that we wouldn't have much to talk about. Andre Paul, who I believe is also a patron, and I'm sorry if I didn't. Keon actually is the one that keeps the list, but I believe that Andre Paul, who's a longtime listener, and I believe also a patron, has asked us. So let me see. Where does your comment begin, my friend? I'm trying to get this through because you have a page. Anyway, so he asks us, do you think we can convince the CAS to overturn the transfer ban, or is it a, quote, necessary evil, unquote, to fulfill the board's obligation to Socios? This is a very interesting question, and it touches on a lot of different subjects that I could talk about for hours, and I'm not going to. What I will tell you, Andre Paul, my man, is this. I do think that there is an element of responsibility by senior management at Real Madrid to the Socios and to, you know, in the idea of, so in the United States, one of the things that is, you know, required of corporations is that they seek profit, and this, you know, they're expected to do, you know, make certain moves within, you know, the kind of large limits of what we call the business judgment rule. Now, there may be a business judgment not to appeal based on how much money you would spend, but it's also possible that there's a belief that this is a requirement because they think that they were treated unfairly and that they think that they are, you know, quote, required to pursue this avenue, given that the board, that they didn't bring anyone in, that they may feel that they could, that this is a requirement based on their money-making imperative. I don't know. But
I think that Real Madrid will appeal whether or not they think that they will win the appeal.
I agree, and that's what I was going
to
say.
In order to make a public relations point that they were treated unfairly and thus have exhausted all possible avenues, because if they don't make the appeal, then they look guilty. It looks like an admission of guilt, and that's more important than the money that they spend on the the appeal. However, I will also say that I'm not a lawyer, and certainly not a lawyer in sports arbitration, but my experience in this has been that CAS appeals are essentially never successful.
So
the standard, as far as I'm aware, is very high in terms of the level of like unfair conduct that
I've had a conversation with Thomas Baker, who is a professor of sports law arbitration at a law school in the United States. I'm sorry, my man, if I don't remember what school year. You know, I'm going to look him up right now. Anyways, we had a conversation recently where we exchanged messages about this arbitration, and it's a very interesting. He's the University of Georgia Law School, and he does sports arbitration. This is a very, very interesting to me aspect where the CAS, unlike most civil arbitral tribunals, does seem to have a body of precedent that it will go back on. And so not only, Josh, is it a very high standard to overturn a institution that is interpreting its own rules, right? So the CAS is the body of law that the CAS is interpreting is FIFA's own rules. So it is interpreting FIFA's own rules that FIFA already interpreted that didn't have room for Madrid, right? So Madrid's argument weren't enough to convince FIFA, which was interpreting its own rules. It also has a body of precedent, unlike any other civil arbitral tribunal that I'm aware of, where it will go back. And so not only does Madrid have to make a coherent argument that FIFA was wrong in interpreting its own rules, it also has to prove to CAS why CAS should distinguish the Real Madrid case from Barcelona's case, where Barcelona was, for similar fact pattern, sanctioned for an entire year, so two transfer windows. And I think when you put those two things together, the idea that CAS might overturn this ban is absolutely absurd. I think there's almost no chance. And that's
yeah. I think it's unlikely. And indeed, to be quite honest, I'm not 100% familiar with the fact pattern. My impression was, at least from what Real Madrid was saying, that the fact pattern was different from what Barcelona was doing. But if indeed the fact pattern is identical, then I think that they should be punished.
Well, Josh, the fact pattern is identical, right, if you take Madrid at their word. And I was doing that when I wrote a couple articles saying basically that.
Right.
But the key thing to me was why I actually thought Madrid really did have a shot of getting this overturned was because Barcelona's argument was basically like, the entire purpose of your law was to protect these kids. Well, La Masia isn't hurting them. There's no element of protecting kids that you need to be worried about. So this shouldn't apply to us in that we are giving them schooling, we're giving them all this stuff. Madrid actually went and contested the factual and legal allegations of every single player that FIFA mentioned.
Right.
And
FIFA
still
ruled against
them.
We talked about this on a podcast in the past. I mean, but Barcelona's defense was essentially to contest that the rule should exist in the first place, but they completely admitted that the fact pattern was true. They basically said, yes, we had these players who were underage, but you shouldn't punish us because what we're doing is not bad, it is good, it is wrong for this rule to exist. Whereas Madrid said, no, in fact, we are in compliance with the law. So that's why we thought that these were two different things. If it turns out, in fact, that Real Madrid were not in compliance with the law, then Real Madrid should be punished the same as Barcelona, in my opinion. But I do not know the answer to that.
So let's move on. We have two quick questions, Josh, so I'll let you get back to working, and I'll get back to working myself, because, of course, we're both working on a Sunday night.
Professionals.
So we're going to ask quickly, cover_shadow asks us, elections in 2017, any idea who should be Perez's successor? I think, to answer your question, that there is, if Perez wants to be reelected, he will be reelected. I don't see anyone beating him.
We've talked about this in the past. There are structural barriers that make it almost impossible for anyone who's not Perez to run. I genuinely don't know if there's anybody else in the entire country who can meet them. So, except for Ramon Calderon.
Or someone like, Ramon. I don't know. I don't.
So you have to be a socio. You have to have been a socio for 30 years, I want to say. You have to be over a certain age, and you have to be able to put up a portion of the operating budget of Real Madrid, which is approximately 80 million euros, by yourself. So there are very few people who meet that standard. So you can't, for example, be like an oil billionaire from Abu Dhabi because you have to have been. Oh, you have to be a Spanish citizen as well. So there are a lot of barriers. There are very few people who are members of the club, long-term members of the club, who have that kind of money to throw around. And the reality is that those rules will have to be disposed of if we want another president.
The only rule that I would really like of all those to dispose of is the 30 million or the portion of the budget one, because there's exactly no reason that someone who doesn't have billions of dollars on hand couldn't be the chairman. Like, that's dumb. I don't like that rule. But everything else, being a Spanish citizen is fine with me. Being a long-term socio is fine with me. All of these are preventing someone from kind of hostile takeover type attack on Madrid, right? And, like, that's all fine with me. So,
necessarily think they should have to be a Spanish citizen. That's kind of weird to me, but
you can get Spanish citizenship pretty easily is the thing, unlike the United States, where if you've been living here for a while on like there for a while under a card, like look at all of the, you know, like Cristiano Ronaldo is a Spanish citizen. So
I just think that if you're a long-term socio, you've been a socio for 30 years, then that should be enough. But It strikes me as a little bit like Spanish nationalist.
Yeah, a little bit. I agree with that
stuff. Like it, whether or not it is a real burden, it strikes me as the kind of thing that like the quasi fascist element, the Franquista element of the fan base, the ultrasur would like. So I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a good point. Good point. There's some questions here that are not ones that we're gonna get to. My good friend Cristian Paredes at @xianchian_d_paredes, who's really wonderful. He runs the Peña Real Madrid in Southern California. He is he and his Peña are, I believe, the subject of a documentary that my brother is filming for Managing Madrid, gentlemen. That is the first preview of that project that I'm giving. So everyone's listening to that. That's the thing that's happening. We're going to have that as our own unique novel video content on the Peña del Sur of the United States. Very cool. So Christian asks us, and the interesting thing, Christian, is that I actually don't know the answer to the first question, but I can guess on the second one. What is the latest on the negotiations with Bale? Do you think he will get upped to $15 million per year? Cheers, and a la Madrid. I don't know what the latest is. I know that we spoke a little bit about Sport reporting that people were upset that he'd asked for a contract renovation. We talked about how we talked about it last podcast, Josh, that, you know, we thought that Sport is just basically a gossip rag that's bullshit, that you shouldn't listen to anything they're saying, that it's very possible and likely that he did ask for a contract to get more money. But the idea that anyone in the dressing room would be upset by that is nonsense. To me.
Yeah, but like, I mean,
who cares? It's better for...
I just why shouldn't he ask for a new contract?
No, that's the point,
that's
right?
Why, like, are fans annoyed? Like,
fans aren't annoyed. I don't think anyone's annoyed that he's asking. Yeah. Like, that's the point, right? Like, I always take the player's side in contract negotiations.
Unless he's like, it's like extortion or something. Like,
but anyways, yeah, $15 million is $5 million less than Cristiano makes. Like, I think that Real Madrid should pay him $15 million a year and have a long-term contract and be psyched.
Lock him down.
Psyched that they get to only pay Bale $15 million a year. I think Bale's worth much more than that. So
he had a great Euro Cup. I mean, he's an
incredible international brand. Also, if you look at the United States, he and Cristiano Ronaldo are basically in Hamas. Are the only people on our team that have a huge following in the Americas. I think that Bale has, and plus he's a character guy, right? Like, he is, you never hear stories about how Bale has any issue in the press. Like, he's a franchise making type of player, both in talent and in personality. He is incredibly great compliment to Cristiano, as Cristiano, you know, gets older. This is a player that you want to lock down, and you want to lock down for a long time. And at $15 million, he's a steal, I think. So, I don't know. I'm sure other people don't feel that way, but man, do I feel strongly about that. Last question, Josh, unless you have, I think that we're basically on the same page on that one. Very, very serious, not a joke question from our very own Om Arvind. Om asks us, Alaves and Las Palmas are going to be the top two in La Liga, aren't they? And to that I say...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's Las Palmas are definitely going to be La Liga champions. I think that's totally reasonable.
Drop that bet in now. You're probably getting, what, Leicester-type odds against that happening. So just
5,001. Actually, probably more.
It might be more because of how good Madrid and Barca are.
Yeah, that would be quite something. They have been on a really incredible run. I don't know if people have been following that, but since the last season, I want to say the second half of last season, Las Palmas have just been playing incredible. And actually, the style has been pretty good, too. I mean, for all the people complaining about Alaves, you certainly can't say that about Las Palmas.
Yeah.
And they play. They're not too hard to look at.
No, exciting.
I would love to see Las Palmas keep doing well. I have a sneaking suspicion that the wheels will come off the bus at some point. But
well, they remind me a little bit, like they're a very high-paced team, right? They hold the ball, they're a high-paced team. That type of team historically hasn't, you know, types like teams like that don't historically do quite as well over a season as they might do in a tournament. Though, let's be clear, I think that my favorite exciting team to watch that kind of plays like that is going to be Sampoli's Sevilla. What a great coach. What a great hire, I think.
I'm intrigued. I'm super intrigued, but I'm also like kind of scared for them, you know?
Yes. Yes. Also.
Like what is happening there?
Yeah.
You know? Like what is going to happen? But I'm, you know, pleased that he's here.
Yeah.
It's gonna be a ride. What was that game that, like, the first game of the season for him? It was like a fucking, like, 5-4 nightmare roller coaster.
Yeah. I forget what that was. No, Sevilla has been really weird and absurd. Let's just quickly look up their season so far, because I think it'd be interesting. They have Juve. That their next game is against Juve. Whoa.
Not what you want.
Oof. All right.
I suspect they're going to get dumped back into the Europa League and then win it again.
They are right now. They're second in La Liga with 7 out of a possible 9 points. So I have a question for you. And this is literally the last thing we're saying, because I got to get off and I got to get to work. You got to get back to work. So I'm seeing that Samir Nasri is on Sevilla, and I'm seeing that Samir Nasri has also dyed his hair bleach blonde.
What is happening? Messi did that too, and looks
Neymar. Neymar
horrible.
Has also done that.
Horrible. Well, I can understand that, like, maybe some of Messi's hair dye got onto Neymar, like, by accident. Or maybe it's, like, a horrible parasite that lives in Messi's brain now, and it, like, you know, I don't know. But what is Nasri's excuse?
I don't know. It just looks terrible.
What's it about France players, man? Benzema doing stupid stuff. Oh my god, that looks so bad. But it's not as bad as these.
Josh, it was great chatting with you. We will do maybe an update in the middle of the week, depending on how everyone's work schedule works out. And Madrid play Sporting, and then Madrid play. Who's the next match? I'm sorry, but I should look this up beforehand. And then Madrid play over the weekend in La Liga against Espanyol. So. That's exciting, and we'll see how that rolls out. So that's Wednesday against Sporting, and then
Sunday
against Espanyol, and we will be back on Sunday at the very latest to recap all those matches and then preview the next one, which will be against Villarreal. That's a very intense game. So, all right, everybody, great chatting with you, and don't forget to rate our podcast on iTunes, and if you would like. We would love you forever, and we will always answer your questions. Please donate to us. Consider donating to us. Patreon, patreon.com/managingmadrid. Any amount that you want to contribute is wonderful. You get more perks as your donation gets larger on the side of the page. If for example, if you choose to donate a $15 donation, recurring donation, we actually will begin writing things for you. We'll have you on the show. Whatever you want. And anyways, thank you so much.
We really appreciate any amount. I mean,
any
really,
amount of money and really any of your support.
Very helpful.
Rating us. We do this.
And even those
of
you who don't donate or can't donate, we appreciate you listening.
We really do.
Like and subscribe on iTunes. That's something you can do for us. 5-star rating.
I forgot to answer the question on Facebook. I always try to do this. Christopher McCormick asked us on Facebook, five scariest away trips this season. I always try to answer the Facebook because we really do want people to engage on Facebook. We do care about our Facebook page and growing that that presence as well. As you know, we've done a lot of video content on Facebook with Keon doing rather significant numbers of Facebook video. And Josh, we did one a while back. I'm actually down to, I may start doing it myself as well. So five scariest away trips this season. I can't answer this without more preparation, my friend. We'll do this on another one, but I will say this, Madrid, away trips to Barcelona are always terrifying.
Calderon, gotta be
the kind of less classic ones. I actually would say that
Valencia, we have a very bad schedule every time.
Even though Valencia has not been very good this year,
I know, but we still do badly, even when they're playing badly.
I will also note that Madrid does not have I always get worried about the few places that Madrid never seems to do well. One of them is in Balaidos against Delta, and the other one, Josh, as we mentioned, is against in Pamplona against Osasuna. Those are the two that I'm circling.
Yeah,
on
I'm not as worried about that this year, to be honest. Historically, very bad, very 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 hard.
And also, obviously, I think in Villarreal.
Bilbao Villarreal.
All right. Great talking to you, my man. We'll do another one. We'll do another one soon. And great chatting. And, you know, a la Madrid.